The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Management of cardiac arrhythmias and conduction disorders is presented by Dr. Robert Chilton.
This is the way you go about treating it. It's heart rate control. Why did I pick propranolol? I could have picked carvedilol, or I could have picked metoprolol. It's because propranolol is where we started from. Propranolol is a racemic mixture. It has two parts to it. One's an L-isomer and one is in the opposite one. This one stabilizes the actual membrane in people that are thyroid toxic. Now, that has been lost in the most recent articles because I think most of the senior guys are not doing as much writing as they used to. We studied this a long time. You want the best? This is currently the best we know for stabilizing that membrane. So under atrial fibrillation, I would certainly pick that as one of my main ones. Now, if you cannot take a beta blocker, what's next up? Probably diltiazem. People with atrial fibrillation frequently will have a low ejection fraction. Those guys need to have beta blockade. Verapamil is the most negative inotropic drug I have. It does slow conduction, but takes a lot of it. So if I had to start with, I'll take the beta blocker first because it actually blocks adrenaline drive when people walk around. And the next one up would be diltiazem, would be the thoughts that I would have. Now, if you have a CHADS score that's elevated in AFib, those guys are more likely to throw emboli. The new oral anticoagulants, whichever one you want to try, are beneficial, and again, they have beat warfarin, so thus have been changed in the last few years. The other part of this is heart rate control. If they ask you about people, which again, number one, over 65 is this arrhythmia, you only target to around 110 and below. Why is this important? We used to study this, and we used to try to drive these guys down, Gail and I did, probably close to 60 or 70. And do you know, we found out it didn't make any difference. So if a guy has AFib, if you get him around 110 or below, he's fine. I would suggest a little bit lower than that, but that was the actual trial. And so the 110 arresting rate is all you really need. Most people do that. But remember, when a guy gets up to walk, if you think you're going to use digitalis, it doesn't really handle the sympathetic drive of walking around. Only the beta blocker does that, or diltiazem. Those are about the only two that will really help on that. This is the RACE 2 trial. This is where that came from. And again, it's a 3-year estimated cumulative incidence for the primary endpoint. And you can see the 110 is all that you really needed. So for that, we're going to stay with 110. That could be very nicely a board question that you might want to be aware of. This is the 2A and in class 3. The only thing you have to look on this slide is the one in bold. It says there is an increased mortality with dordoterone in heart failure patients. Don't use that. Now, if you want to start a drug like that, my suggestion would be is to get somebody in electrophysiology to look at the patient with you, because most of these are carrying off-target effects that are not friendly. But again, if you have heart failure, this is the one that kind of surprised folks when this was published, and it changed the way we did things. We thought that this would have less toxicity than amiodarone. It may. It's just we've not studied it as long. But it's still used by a lot of us. But again, not in heart failure, folks. Stay away from that because you get in trouble. This is CHADS 2. I have more than the slides that I need for this 30-minute section, so I have to be careful on time. This is CHADS 2. You must know this. If you do not know this, you will not do well, because this is most of the patients you see that are over 75. These people need to be started on drugs that actually like a NOAC or Coumadin. I happen to like the NOACs, but again, it costs a lot more money. You're going to have to, again, mix and match some patients to different ones. For artificial valves, Coumadin still holds the number one slot. We have not switched that. We tried NOACs at one time and we clotted our valves, so we don't do that. So use Coumadin for those guys. Over 75, if you want to do somebody with Coumadin, you have to balance falling and breaking a hip versus the drug's benefit. unfortunately, a breaking hip is really high end and people die from that. So if somebody's very functional, it doesn't fall much, not a problem as much. But they have to get stuck a lot. So again, we went to 10As and we went to direct thrombin inhibitors. That is not a PAR1 inhibitor. We don't probably see many people taking the PAR1 blockers, but certainly the direct thrombin inhibitor, dabigatran, and the use of the other 10A common pathway blockers are really common. But watch these numbers. You need to know this. There is a CHADS-VAS2 score that gives you a little bit more specificity if you want to use it. But for general purposes, I think this covers most of the patients. They're not going to trick you and ask you 1 point difference. They don't have to. Again, there's just too much material. Rate control is still the recommended thing. Beta blockers where I start from. And again, watch the low ejection fraction. The asthma folks, if you run into trouble, the next choice up for most of us is going to be something like diltiazem for rate control. You can certainly move into amiodarone if all the antiarrhythmic drugs that I can think of, that covers the best of everything. The problem is it also has the ugliest side effects of everything. I'm not sure exactly where it works, but I can tell you that it's 1/6 the potency of propranolol. When you first give this drug, it blocks heart rate response. This drug came from South Africa. This drug was invented for ischemic heart disease, for angina, and actually improves the ischemic bed. That was studied actually in Cape Town with Lionel Opie. This is old, old drug, but it does a great job for, again, blocking arrhythmias. So when everything else fails, I always pull out amiodarone. It usually works. It's even in the ACLS guidelines to give you kind of an interesting idea where it sits. Post-op AFib, what do we know about that? Well, one is, we know one thing, don't be using beta blockers. There's been at least two or three studies in the last probably 2 to 3 years, which is probably borderable, that if you have not been taking a beta blocker and you want to start it on it, you'll knock them over faster. So if the patient's taking it, it's okay. If the patient's not taking it, don't start it because it may slow them down too much and they'll have other problems. There's a lot of things on this slide. Only look at the things that are actually class 1 and class 3. We don't ask you class 2 because everybody, it's kind of like a throw everything in the pot in class 2. You don't miss that. The one you'll miss is a class 1 or a class 3. So when you look at these, watch these very carefully. Ablation for AFib is becoming more common. Marty and guys like him who do these things can ablate, and it depends on the center. I would find somebody that's fairly senior that does a lot of this ablation if you want AFib. It can be very effective, but probably more than half the time, they got to have a second one. So I kind of warn patients that I send to EP guys that do this that, you know, it's possible you could have a stroke, but it's not high, but it's possible. And two, you may not get it done the first time. Then they're much more pleased than you'd think when they send them the first time that you're going to cure it forever. That may not be the case. These are tricky. These are harder than you think to do. And if you go and watch one and you spend time in the labs with these guys, this is a lot of work. So young people that have AFib, small left atriums or something like that, something the EP guy feels like he can get to and ablate, I like it. I think it works great. But again, it depends on the case. It needs to have an EP consultation. Summary points for this section, there are basically five. Don't be doing thyroid testing on every guy that's got AFib that's old. I'm not sure it's worth the time and it's not approved. Again, heart rate control for people that have thyroid disease, beta blockers, number one. Number two pick would be diltiazem. The diltiazem versus verapamil comes from studies we did on actually the effect of negative inotropism with pressure volume loop curves. Diltiazem is the least negative inotrope that controls the actual dromotropic conduction the best. So that's the one I would use. Heart rate control, 110 is my magic number. Stay under that, you're fine. Don't be trying to drive it to 60. You don't need to do that. There is a more increased mortality if you have severe heart failure with dordoterone. But again, I think if you want to start that, I would recommend you ask one of the EP guys to think over your case with you. He may have a better option. And then again, here's the CHADS-2 score. And again, this is important. You need to know how to calculate this. It's not hard. These people need to be on anticoagulation and to make sure that it works best. There are some new guidelines that have come out within the last year. The board wasn't written last year. It was written probably the year before. So don't be picking the new stuff that just came out because it's not going to be on there. Now, let's go to primary V for a minute and think about it for a second. Is there actually some kind of a syndrome that actually is the number one cause of not secondary ventricular fibrillation like you have ischemic disease, but primary? You would flat have it. Well, there is. And if you don't look at it every day, it's not something you think about. Here's a case. 30-year-old guy, maybe he's a cyclist, jogger, whatever you want to call him. This guy comes into the EKG after having a full cardiac arrest. Enzymes don't go up, didn't have a heart attack. What happened to him? So he had fallen into the primary V-fib range. If you look at his EKG in V1 and 2, you'll see that it looks a little ST elevation, but at the same time, it's got a little bit widening of the QRS. This is Borgata syndrome. Look at this carefully. Plant this in your eye, because you don't see many, but if you see it, this is a special group of folks. And this came out of Italy to the first that I know of. And they started publishing on this, and it's been around ever since. But watch for this one. The treatment of choice has varied within the last week. We have some new information base. But I think if the patients arrested and had this, I probably would pick the AICD on this case. If you take a look at Borgata syndrome, it has a distinct form of idiopathic ventricular fibrillation. It's got a right bundle. ST elevations look like an angioma, but there's no troponin leaks. Now, there may be a troponin leak from the fact he had a cardiac arrest, but it's not the classic MI. And if you look at the actual numbers, you don't find structural heart disease, but it's around 40 to 60% of the cases of idiopathic ventricular fibrillation. So again, it's one you need to be aware of for the test, and again, has seen in South Asians, apparently healthy people, that just drop over. Is this uncommon? Have I seen this? I've seen two cases of this, and Marty may have probably had more, but this is not something that you don't see. Living close to Mexico, some interesting cases come up. Where have you isolated this to? Well, what we found is there's a mutation in the specific sodium gene. I don't think they're going to ask you that, but the one I show you here, the sodium channel, the SCN5A, is a fairly frequent one for the electrophysiology guys. They talk about this. So you might be aware of this. It is seemed to be family related, shown right here. And this Borgata syndrome is one that I think is nice testable. If you just identify it, the patient's not arrested, most of us are probably going to go beta blockers. If the family or the brother or people like that have had V-fib suddenly, then I think you need to make a judgment with the family and patients. But as far as shifting the guidelines, I think most of us are concerned if you have this, they might actually fibrillate. The case I give you, the guy had full arrest, that guy's going to get a fibrillator. But if you had the brother come in and he has got the same looking EKG and he's not arrested, probably a beta blocker is not a bad idea for him. But again, I'd get an EP consultation. That may require even more sophisticated EP information base that has been housed in different parts of the United States that could give you a direct block for that. And you may want to actually study that patient at one of the universities. A lot of money, but people that are interested in this will probably do it for you. At the very bottom line of this paper, and again, it shows you the three people that wrote the paper, you'll see underlined amiodarone and or beta blocker did not prevent against sudden death. That's a bothersome from the guys who actually invented the syndrome. So I'd probably tend to say if the guy arrested, I'd probably put a defibrillator in this guy. This is a testing, and you can see the different shifts in the actual patient. On the same patient, you can see how we can change the sodium channel and make it look differently. That just tells us that we're on the right track. You won't be doing this. Most EP guys are not going to be doing this unless you're in a research area or you're interested in this. Quite honestly, if we have one like this, we'll probably do it because the house staff loves to do these kind of procedures. But for routine guys, you don't have time to mess with this. Let's go to pacemakers for a little bit in the next 11 minutes. If you take a look at this, if you don't read EKGs every day, take a look carefully and see what you think. The 76-year-old person, and you see up there, you can see there's a drop beat in the middle. You can see that the atrial sinus P waves are coming out straight across in control, all the way across. I want to make 2 points on the EKG. One is, if you see a wide QRS complex, it's deep in the conduction circuits. Maurice Lev and other guys many years ago have written a lot of papers on this. You could classify this as a second degree V block. But is it type 1 or is it type 2? Type 2 gets you a pacemaker. But in the fact that that's wide, I'm probably going to be able to find me another strip in the trash can that's got two beats in a row. So for this one, this guy is probably going to get a pacemaker. Now, if you want to get real particular, you can go in and do electrophysiology study, and sometimes that's necessary. If you're not real sure, you can take this guy and walk him on the treadmill and see if he actually starts dropping beats. If he speeds his heart rate up and starts conducting, then it's more likely to not be the actual MOBITS 2. MOBITS 2 guys don't seem to do that too often. So the YQRS is what tips me off to send me the HIS-Purkinje system. That's not a safe system, and probably for this guy, he's probably going to end up with more of a pacemaker type direction. Now, this you have to know. This one sheet, look at this, it has not changed. It has been in every guidelines we've published. You got to show me a documented 3-second pause. If you can't show me that, then I'm going to have a problem getting paid for it. As a matter of fact, I saw one of my colleagues get a letter from the actual insurance company. Why did you put this pacemaker in? It wasn't indicated. So document it and put it in your chart. You must fit these criteria. Now, you're not putting the pacemaker in. That's going to be the electrophysiology guy. But this is the guidelines we would expect you to at least have basic understanding of. The blue arrow is for the board exams. This is for you. Notice down there, we have neuromuscular disease in AV block. The reason I put that in there is because I had a patient that had limb girdle, and that guy got a pacemaker because his brother dropped dead and crashed his car, and he had the same thing. So if you have somebody, that's a class one indication. These guys get blocks, and again, you have to be kind of careful which ones you pick. But this one's on the board, that's a class one, so watch for that one to come up. That's a nice one for if you're into primary care, that could easily be something you'd see. And then again, here's your secondary AV block type 2 with a left bundle. That's the one that I showed you. Now we've added symptoms to it. That classifies as it moves it more into a malignant type of arrhythmia, and one would require pacing. Now, defibrillator implants, in the last few minutes that I have, is changed a little bit, but not a lot. Probably the most important things on the defibrillator implants is that we're going to put these things in people with low ejection fractions, people that actually have somebody that have had a cardiac arrest. If you didn't know what caused it, that guy's probably going to get a unit. So let me walk through a few of these. These are in your handout, and you can read them. And again, it's a case, 45-year-old female. She has an anterior MI, and then she fibrillates on hospital day 4. Would she be a candidate for an defibrillator implant? Now, you're not going to put this in. But again, one of your colleagues you're going to have to call and ask the question to. And then here again shows you the actual class one indications. Now, there are new indications that keep coming out, but the bottom line hasn't changed. You got to have it more than 48 hours out. If you tell me it was 12 hours out and the patient fibrillated, that doesn't count. But if it's more than 48 hours and it's not due to something that transient, probably most of us are going to be in the air of putting a defibrillator in because they're really having some problems. The other ones, you're going to have to wait 40 days before you can do anything, and that has not changed just a whole lot. And again, Marty can modify my comments when he gets here. Here's a class one. This is the latest stuff that I have. Again, if you want to go for evaluation, you need to do that ejection fraction, and it needs to be, again, after 40 days. If it is a low ejection fraction, then I think a consult with the electrophysiology guy would be certainly important to you. And there's the reference for that at the bottom. This is the appropriateness criteria post-infarction. This is only a sample, which means, do you have appropriateness criteria? I have given you a list of articles on the internet of all the ones I think that it would be current. But these appropriateness criteria let you know what your colleagues think of how you're practicing, I guess. And the ones that say A is acceptable. The ones that say R, that's rarely appropriate. And they will give you scenarios like you see up here on this slide. So you need to look at the appropriateness criteria for different types of cardiovascular diseases, and we have those, but certainly not in 30 minutes. You can go through all of them. Most of these are probably close to 50 or 60 pages long. Some are over 200 pages. But be aware, these are out there, and we write questions off of this. It's going to be difficult to argue against a question that comes up on appropriateness if it's a class A, so watch for these. This is recommended for resynchronization therapy. That hasn't changed a whole lot. Certainly, if somebody has a YQRS complex, low ejection fraction, that's probably will be enough for what you will need to know. The electrophysiology person then will be more sophisticated and nail it down exactly what you need, but it's a class one indication. Does it work? It really works. Some patients do extremely well with this. So I would certainly be aware that people do get resynchronized. They have bad pumps. Are you going to see bad failure your patients in your practice? You will, because we can't handle all of them. Is the incidence of these getting more? They are. They're growing, and heart failure is growing in the admissions to the hospital. Anytime you have a patient with heart failure and he comes back within the first month, the hospital has to pay for it. So they are definitely going to target this. So watch for this one. This is an important area. This is the other last one I'm going to talk about. This has to do with the epsilon waves. If you look very carefully down here, you can see on this cardiomyopathy the actual arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia, and I've blown this up as best I can find on all kinds of Google images to get you a good picture. This is not something that's real common, but I have had probably a couple of cases of this one. Over the last 30 years, we've seen this. So watch for this one for the board exams. It's very nice, it's very clean, and you can see it on MRI scan with some of the changes. Here again shows you the actual pictures, and you can see the fatty infiltration that I've blown up in the histologic example over here, and you can see the areas of the fat in the heart. It makes a person so they have bad outcomes and arrhythmias. So be careful with this one. This shows you the MRI scan. The point of this slide is that I show it to you on the left and the right side of the heart. Most people who've written papers many years ago said it was on the right side. We got MRI scans that came into being, and what we found was it's also on the left side. So you can have fat on both sides, and both of them can be arrhythmogenic and give you lots of problems. A V-fib arrest is going to get you a defibrillator. And then again, here are the criteria, how you can diagnose it. I'm not going to go through those, but you can see those in two criteria that are major, and then again, how you mix and match them. That's the best that we know. The MRI scan probably for the board exams is the best one to pick, because that will show you the fat infiltration, and then you would put it with your arrhythmia, and you would get the diagnosis.